Welcome to the People in the Red Vest, a podcast of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, the IFRC. I'm your host, Alexandra Sasha Goryshuk, and in each episode, we feature inspiring, surprising, and thought-provoking conversations with people who dedicate their lives to helping others.
I know for a fact that I have been treated with kindness all around the world. I know that I have had help and support from at least one individual from every country around the world to achieve what I set out to do. And there's a big difference between being told that the world is a better place and full of kind and generous people and knowing it for a fact because you've experienced it on your own body.
Today, we share with you the second part of my interview with Thorbjørn Thor Pedersen. Thor made history by visiting every country in the world in one trip, without ever taking an airplane. But that's not all. Along the way, as a goodwill ambassador for the Danish Red Cross, he visited with volunteers and staff of 190 Red Cross and Red Crescent National Societies. He also wrote stories for his travel blog about their life-saving work. If you haven't listened to the first part of the interview, take a listen to the previous episode, episode 6, in this season of People in the Red Vest. So what forms of transportation did you take?
Public transportation, buses, trains, ferries, taxis even, all of this. Then eventually you find out that you cannot connect the world with public transportation. Not unless you fly. So I also joined about 40 container ships, primarily within the Pacific, but also some for connecting the continents and also for reaching some of the African island nations. I've traveled with anything you can imagine. I've traveled with a bicycle, I've traveled with a police car, I've traveled with a horse carriage, I've traveled with a high-performance yacht, with the Boda Bodas, which are motorcycle taxis, or generally motorcycle taxis around the world. I travel with shared motorcycle taxis, meaning that you have the driver, me, and other people on the motorcycle. Shared taxis, bush taxis, where you would fit 12 people, 10, 12 people into a Toyota Corolla. And you hope the brakes and the wheels and everything, the steering holds up.
Let's talk about some numbers.
Sure.
How many countries did you go to? How many Red Cross, Red Crescent National Societies did you visit?
Right. So there are different numbers for how many countries there are in the world. And this usually calls for a bottle of red wine and and then you talk. But generally, we can agree by the numbers of United Nations, which is 193. The United Nations then has two observer states, and then often people include Kosovo, so 196, and you can split the UK and do Wales and Northern Ireland and Scotland. You can split Denmark and do Faroe Islands and Greenland. There's Western Sahara, there's Taiwan. So you can keep growing your list. If you're going to leave home and not come back until you've been to every country in the world, it's wiser to go with a high number than a low. So I went with my list of 203 countries. I met with the movement in 199 of those countries. So I met with the British Red Cross in Scotland and in Wales and in Northern Ireland, but counted those as individual countries. I met with the Greenland Red Cross, which would be under the Danish Red Cross. I reached 190 out of 192 national societies. And I would have gone to all 192, but there were logistical difficulties.
Right now, just for clarity for our audience, right now we have 191 national societies of the Red Cross and Red Crescent, but over the span of 10 years, that has changed. So this is why the numbers differ a little bit. I think by now it's clear that your journey took quite some time. Mm. Altogether, it was...
Yeah, 9 years, 9 months and change.
How does it feel to be home?
It feels good to have the project behind me, because the project eventually grew into being a mental prison. And nowhere was it clearer than Hong Kong, that I was within a prison, but I had the key in my hand. And I could have used that key at any moment, but there were consequences in terms of using that key. So it was all on my shoulders, like building a card house. Like you're not too worried with the first few cards at the bottom level. The higher you go, your hands start shaking. And I was coming very close to the end, this massive card house. So coming home, I feel free for the first time in almost a decade. I'm not waking up to a list of destinations I have to go to. I choose where I want to go. I choose who I meet with. I choose which collaborations I say yes to based on what I think is good for me or what I want to do. I'm free in a way that I have not been for 10 years. And people generally don't understand that because they saw me as a traveler and they say, that's the ultimate freedom. You were traveling for 10 years. Look at you. We were doing the dishes and going to work. You were meeting people. I said, yeah, but eventually that itself became work. And because of very strict rules, I was locked in a very, very difficult way.
What were those rules? And they were set by you, weren't they?
They were. I was a prisoner of my own ambition. This is the shortest way that I can say it with words. I was a prisoner of my own ambition. The rules were absolutely no flight. If I passed out and I was evacuated on an airplane, the project would be over. So no flights. Minimum 24 hours. My country average was 17 days per country, 17 or 18 days per country. But minimum 24 hours to validate it as a visit within a country. And then at least you get a couple of meals and you get a night's sleep and you meet some people, right? 24 hours is nothing, but this is an achievement project. It's not about spending. If you spend 7 days in every country around the world, you have to set aside 4 years of your life. If you spend 1 month in every country in the world, you have to set aside 16 years of your life. So you have to be very, very cautious with time management. So we have no flying, we have minimum 24 hours, and then we had to ensure that there would be no debate if it was one journey or more than one journey. So no return home until I reached the final country or if I quit the project. And I was going back and forth over this in Hong Kong as the pandemic locked everything down and more pages fell off the calendar and like, how long is this going to take? And I realized that I had a choice. I could quit and people would say, you got really far. You probably got further than anyone else would and so, or I could complete and become the man who did it. And I would much, much rather be the one who did it than the one who said, I can't.
What kind of person one has to be able to do that?
It's a good question. So your question relates to character traits. Mm-hmm. And I once sat down with a nice young man in Uganda, and we defined three character traits, which without these three, there's no way you're completing anything like this. So the first one that we defined was stubbornness, that you have to have this almost psychotic stubbornness where it doesn't make sense anymore, but you're still getting up in the morning, brushing your teeth, washing your face, and smiling to people, making your way through life. You have to be the most stubborn person in the room every time you walk into a room, because if you give up once, it's over. Mm-hmm. The second one was you have to be of a creative mind, because often people will say this is impossible or it has never been done before or there's no way, but you have to find the way. So you have to think out of the box. And the higher degree you have of this creative thinking, the better served you will be. And then the third is your connection to other people. Because reality is that no one is going to achieve anything great in life on their own. Everything is bound into other people and how we collaborate and the synergy. So if I could not find the solutions, then for sure the solutions would be found in other people. So you have to be able to connect with those people. So you have to be likable, or you have to have like this social gene, social character trait that connects you to other people so they come on board, either because they like you or they like what you're doing. So these three. And then generally I like to add one character trait, which is not a necessity to complete what I did, but it makes it more helpful. And that is that I have a high degree of personal adaptability. So it doesn't matter if it's warm or it's cold, if it's crowded or if I'm alone, I will find the best in the situation. I will adapt to my environment.
I wanted to ask you about your personal sacrifice, basically, that you and your family probably had to pay for you to complete this project.
Yeah.
When you left family behind.
Yes.
You also had a girlfriend, and I think you got married during your journey?
I think we did.
You think you did? Do you want to tell us about your family and your wife?
Yeah. So I do not have children. So I do not have my own family. I have sisters. I have my mother and father is still alive. I have cousins and so on. Friends, absolutely. They grew accustomed to me coming in and out of the country, because for the past 8 years of my life within shipping and logistics, I was working on projects all around the world.
And this was before you started this journey.
This is before I started. So they knew that I would show up, I would have great stories, we would sit down, we would have a good evening, and I'd sort of do a tour of Denmark and visit different friends and then go out and work on a project again somewhere. So I was this guy. This is a stretch, though, with every country in the world without flying, and that it took 10 years. I had friends and family come out and visit me, but I didn't see people as much as I would have if I had had a normal life, obviously. The personal sacrifice has been my mental state, where I am balancing out a lot of things. I've been through a lot. And I have to weigh out if I can land on my own or if I need help. But it's been a lot. And I'm hoping that my personal adaptability will guide me to where I need to be. I have tremendous support from my wife, maybe wife, maybe not wife. We'll get to that in a moment. and good friends and good community. Now, the sacrifice has maybe also been that I was 34 when I left home, and I was 44 when I came back. And my parents were 65 and 75 when I came home. And my wife was 30 and also 30 when I came home, because that's how that works, right? But in reality, 10 years has also passed for her. And it might be too late for us to start our own family. And it might not have been if I didn't do this, or if I came home 5 years earlier. So you could look at that as a sacrifice. Now, are we married? Are we not married? We were a couple when I left home and decided to stay in a long distance relationship. And we had our ups and downs, and we found a way to make it work, and it started to work really well. And I decided this is the one, and I got on one knee on top of Mount Kenya. And gave her a ring, and she said yes. And then from that point onward, we were engaged. And then years later, I found myself in Hong Kong. stuck during the pandemic, and there was no way she was getting inside Hong Kong as my fiance. But we found out that Hong Kong would accept her if we were married. So how do you deal with that when one of us is in Hong Kong and the other one is in Denmark? It turns out that there is an agency in Utah that marries people online, so through a video call. And we pursued that, and it's a long story, but long story short, we got married online and got some official paperwork, and Hong Kong accepted. I got a visa, sent it to her, and she flew to Hong Kong, quarantined at a hotel for 3 weeks, and then we were together. And then we were married in the US and in Hong Kong, maybe China. But Denmark said, this is nonsense. You cannot get marriage online is nothing. You know, you're not in the same room. This is not valid. So we knew we were going to get married once again. And eventually I managed to leave Hong Kong and I was in the Pacific, and she came and saw me, my maybe wife came and saw me in Vanuatu. And by chance, we came across some people that could organize. And this wonderful woman from Germany, Tina, organized on our behalf. And we had a nice Vanuatuan wedding. And we cut the cake and photos and everything, and had official paperwork, signed it. And that was supposed to transfer to Denmark. But so far, the Danish government has not accepted it. So we know that we're married in Utah, Hong Kong, and Vanuatu.
All right. Let's hope that Denmark recognizes you, but
or a third wedding, maybe.
Or a third wedding, yeah. Why not?
Why not?
Always good to throw a party, right?
Absolutely.
So, you've talked about some of the effects that the journey has had on you. What are some of the takeaways that you bring home from your journey? What did you learn about the world and about yourself that will help you go through life, and it can also give to others? What can we all learn from your experience?
There's a lot to unpack in your questions. But I think I would say, let's start with what did I learn? What did I gain from this? I've discovered that I have a source of strength within myself that will carry me incredibly far. And I can sit down and wonder if that is unique to me or if everybody has that. And I just somehow found a way to activate it. So maybe we can all fight a lot harder than what we initially think we can, even when it doesn't make sense. So this is something that I still reflect upon. I have a knowledge that no one else on this planet has. I know for a fact that I have been treated with kindness all around the world. I know that I have had help and support from at least one individual from every country around the world to achieve what I set out to do. And there's a big difference between being told that the world is a better place and full of kind and generous people and knowing it for a fact because you've experienced it on your own body. And this takes us to, what can I bring other people? So hopefully I can inspire and motivate people, and I can give people a different worldview. Because most of us tend to want to believe that the world is a better place and that people are just people and you'll find kindness. But when you press people, then there's always one country where they don't think it's the case. And I know it's also the case in that country because we are incredibly connected, even when it doesn't seem like we are. We are so much the same. And to use a modern term, and our brains are programmed. And you're brought up with certain programming and nothing else. Because it's still two arms and two legs in most cases, and 10 fingers and nails and one tongue and two eyes. And, you know, we are so identical that if someone puts inside your head that the people on the other side of that line are complete idiots, or they're less, they have less value than you do and your friends and your family have, then it's just programming. it's people across both sides. So I came back home and looked at what is the value in what I did. And then I realized that as long as I'm dealing with people, it's like playing a reversed lottery. In a conventional lottery, you place your bet, you expect to lose, but you hope to win. With people, I know I'm winning constantly. My chances of winning are almost 100%. I know I can lose, and I have lost a few times, but I know that the odds are in my favor.
I think you described very well the first and perhaps the most important of our fundamental principles, humanity.
Hmm.
I think that's what you're talking about. We're all the same and we all belong to it. And we should all trust and believe in the best in the other person.
Definitely.
So you've told us some stories. I know there's many, 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 many more. And you're doing a lot of speaking and interviews, media appearances, and you're working on a book.
Yes.
And a documentary.
Yes.
How are those coming along?
They're slowly but surely coming along. So hopefully we'll have a book ready in English mm-hmm. in early 2025. Mm-hmm. And we currently have a documentary which is about 2 hours long and watchable at this stage, but it still needs some work and editing. And probably people will be looking into releasing both the book and the documentary at the same time for synergy. But the documentary is probably ready 2024.
Okay. That's great. Can't wait to see it.
Yeah, me too. I've only seen the trailer, which is 2 minutes and 20 seconds. So,
does it have video from that you brought from your journey?
It has a mixture.
Actual footage?
The idea for the documentary came about maybe 5 years ago. And a professional was sent out to interview me and film me.
Mm-hmm.
And his name is Mike Douglas. He's Canadian, and I've met with him several times across the world. So he came out 4 times in total. He also gave me a couple of cameras and said, film yourself. When you're happy, film yourself. When you're angry, film yourself. Just get some emotion, film yourself. Because I left Denmark with a picture and words project. So I was doing this blog, I was doing social media. Social media was a different creature in 2013, not so much video-based. But I never felt comfortable with cameras and video. I felt I could control it, the narrative, if it was a photo and text. So this was my medium. And he's so frustrated, the director, because there's very little video footage from the early years.
Mm-hmm.
But then gradually, there's more and more video. And certainly mm-hmm. since Hong Kong, there's plenty.
We usually ask our guests to bring an object that means something to them to the podcast. And I know that you brought several.
Yeah.
So would you mind showing us and telling us about them?
Sure. Well, let's start with my water bottle here. I can't remember what I had before I reached Jamaica. But within the first year, I reached Jamaica and they gave me a plastic water bottle. And that was my water bottle ever since. But then eventually I wanted to clean the bottle for hygienic purposes. And I poured hot water into it. And it was made of plastic, so it melted. And so that bottle was replaced by this one from the...
Maybe show it to the camera.
From the Swiss Red Cross. And it's metal. And this was my water bottle until I reached home. So this would have been from 2017 to 2023.
Wow.
This was my...
So that's object number one.
That's object number one. Yeah. I have this one, which I think just kind of shows the difference of going the extra mile for people in general.
Uh-huh.
I got this one in Lebanon.
Uh-huh.
And it's just... like a small little trinket. You get these around the world. I have a lot of something similar.
But this one is a plaque or a medal.
This one is personalized.
Uh-huh.
So this one has my name and the project name, Once Upon a Saga. And it also has the year that I visited the Lebanese Red Cross.
Which is?
2017, mm-hmm. I think, 2017. So the interesting thing for me is that anyone could have made that little plaque. It's not a lot of work to send someone downtown to do that. But they did it.
Yes.
And most other people didn't. So it's just mm-hmm. the extra mile. And that's really my experience with the Lebanese Red Cross, that they are phenomenal. They mm-hmm. And I think that if you live and work in an environment where you're tested constantly, you excel. And we in Denmark, we do not have the armed conflicts. We do not have the huge disasters. We're good. Danish Red Cross is good with some things. But in Lebanon, they're constantly tested. Mm-hmm. And this makes them razor sharp. They're so good in Lebanon. Okay, so let's run.
Object number three.
Let's run a little quick through some of this. Again, I have, I don't even know how many t-shirts I have. But I have two where the National Society, in this case, Mozambique, where they wrote names and small greetings.
Wow.
And
fantastic.
It's again, it's going the extra mile.
Uh-huh.
And it makes it personal for me. Because, again, I have t-shirts from around the world. And it's just something that someone took down the shelf. But this one is something that 5 or 10 people,
mm-hmm.
they put effort into. And I can say the same for this one. Also received a few names on it. And on the back side, it says, stop diarrhea. Always drink safe and clean water.
Yeah. This is Zambia Red Cross?
Yes, Zambia Red Cross Society.
Or the Netherlands?
So they're in collaboration with Netherlands Red Cross. But it was from Zambia Red Cross.
A WASH project, very important.
And I received the name. They brought me to a village in Zambia where they did a WASH project. And I connected with the villagers, and the villagers, they gave me a local name, which I forget which is. But I remember the English word for it, which is family man.
Uh-huh.
So in their local language, they called me family man, which was really nice. This one makes me proud. This is a certificate of honorary membership of the Seychelles Red Cross.
Wow.
And it was a hard country to reach.
Mm-hmm.
It's very far into the Indian Ocean, and there are no ferry connections. But when I finally got there, I was received with a lot of heart warmth, and they're doing a really good job. And I'd certainly feel like I connected with Seychelles Red Cross. This here is the letter of intent from the Danish Red Cross. I was sent into the world with this document, which asks of all the national societies to find a way to help and support mm-hmm. me if they can. So that was that. And then I have a lot of pins from around the world. And in some way, every pin I have is special to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I just have I brought a few today, which are extra special. And then this, before I show the pins, I might just show you this medallion, which is Together for Humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And in Arabic, it reads Humanitarian Ambassador of the Sudanese Red Crescent. And it has more value to me today than when I received it back in 2016, I would say. Because it was a mostly peaceful country in 2016. And today, 8, maybe 10 million people have been displaced. And it's a different situation. Yes. So I have this pin from the Bahamas Red Cross, which says, Life Member.
Okay.
It's also a nice one to have. I have this one from the Kenya Red Cross, which says, Life Member also.
All right.
And then this one is just special to me because it's from the Cuban Red Cross. And most people probably don't get to go to Cuba. And most people likely do not meet with the Cuban Red Cross. And I managed to get this pin from them, which I just think is special in its own sense. And that's what I brought for you today.
Very nice. Thank you for that, Thor. In closing, we could keep talking. I know we could keep talking, and I know we will after we turn this off. But in closing, with all that's going on in the world and everything that you've seen, I know you were very positive about the humanity side. With all that you've experienced, what keeps you going? What gives you hope, comfort? What inspires you?
I'm inspired by people. I think that I have, fortunately, a lot of achievements within my life. I've achieved a lot, is a different way to say it. And I feel like those achievements fade a little bit over time, that the value in the achievements do not stand as clear as in the moment that they were achieved. But the human connections are still strong. And I remember Dafala in Sudan, and I remember people around the world. I probably right now could connect with people in 170 or 180 countries around the world and still have them within my network. And knowing that, not that people are inherently good, because I don't know that to be self-evident, but certainly that most people are not in a position to show you anything else, that there's no reason for most people to harm you or cheat you or steal from you, or most people will just be generous. Most people around the world will, certainly as long as it's free to them, they will put you in their car and take you to where you're going. If they're going that way, they will help you with a translation. They will point you in the right direction. And then you can see how helpful people truly are at the moment when it starts to cost them something. So if they're actually going in the different direction, but they're still putting you in the car and taking you to where you need to go, it costs them time. If they take you in and feed you or give you a place to stay for the night, it's starting to cost them something. And that kind of hospitality, the world is rich in that kind of hospitality. So that keeps me going, with the knowledge of that I can go to any country in the world and come across humanity.
The name of this podcast is The People in the Red Vest. Along your journey, I'm sure you saw many people wearing it.
Sure.
Did you ever put it on?
Yes, that too.
What does it mean to you? What, in your view, the red vest represents?
I largely connect with volunteers. I think that's the most honorable part of the movement, that it's millions of people who want to give a part of themselves to make the world a better place. And I think those vests, for me, represent volunteers knocking on doors and handing out food and filling out paperwork and doing humanitarian work on every conceivable level. The thing that I realized across the past 10 years is that there's such good branding within the Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Crystal. But there's such good branding that generally when you ask people, have you heard about the Red Cross, they'll go, yes. And then if you say, okay, tell me three things about it, then people will struggle. And then depending on where you are, they might say blood, or they might say relief, or they might say something else. But the reality of the movement is that it's endless. And anything that relates to humans on this planet, the red vests are connected to that. They are engaging in that globally. And it's astonishing. So for most people, they will never know what the Red Cross has to offer until they need it. And I think that's an interesting perspective.
Thank you, Thor, for sharing your journey with us, or just a piece of your journey with us. And I'm sure that we will speak again soon.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening to People in the Red Vest, a podcast of inspiring stories as told by people from the IFRC. This podcast was produced by Malcolm Lucard and me, Alexandra Sasha Goryshek, with production and engineering support from Damien Naylor. Promotion and marketing by Maxime Bouchard and Irina Ruano, graphic design by Valentina Shapiro, and web support from Chris Sacqua. For more inspiring stories, subscribe to wherever you listen to podcasts.